The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. Yes, we're back from Cannes. I do hope you enjoyed our output from the Croisette. This week, we bring a little bit of the south of France back with us. Now, I'm not talking about my duty-free rosé, but a quick chat with the Palme d'Or winner, Apichatpong Virasatakul, director of the reincarnation ghost story, Uncle Boonmi, who can recall past lives. If I come back, I want to be a Rolling Stone, or at least one of them back in 1971, at the villa in Nelcott, making Exile on Main Street. I've got an extended interview with the men behind a beautiful new documentary about that decadent time. Stones in Exile is the film. Director Stephen Kayak and producer John Batzek take us through it. It's even more loose-lipped than Mick Jagger. It's Film Weekly. First things and first places first. The surprise winner of the Palme d'Or last Sunday night at Cannes was Thailand's Apichatpong Virasatakul. His beautiful, weird, spiritual film, Uncle Boonmi, Who Can Recall Past Lives, triumphed unexpectedly and gave a refreshing shot in the arm to a Cannes competition badly in need of a dose of originality. The 39-year-old filmmaker, whose previous films, Tropical Malady and Syndromes in a Century, have beguiled and baffled audiences, collected the Palme d'Or and then came straight to London, where he's presenting a brand new work, The Phantoms of Nebula, at the BFI Gallery on the South Bank. I couldn't possibly deny you, gentle Film Weekly listeners, a chance to hear from the current world champion of filmmaking. So I called the director to find out more about his new exhibit, the making of the Palme d'Or winner, and how to pronounce his name properly.
In the Thai way, you know, it's very low sound. It's called Apichatpong Virasatakul.
But they call you Joe as well?
Yes, this is a simplified thing. It's just a name.
But I'm going to call you Apichatpong. I think it's a very lovely name. I'm a big fan of your work and Thai film as well, actually, because I've been to the Bangkok Film Festival. But they never have actually Thai films like yours. You know, this is a different kind of movie from anything that was in Cannes as well, which is why I think Tim Burton, the head of the jury, kind of went for it as well. It surprised everyone. Can you just tell us a bit about your idea for the movie, because it has so many thoughts in it? How did you build the project over 3.5 years? Is this the film, the final film? Is this the one that you had in your mind, or did it change as you were going through making it?
Yeah, like other films, it's always it's very organic way of filmmaking. You know, we change along the way, and of course we have a script because we need to apply for funding. And we work along with the installations and other art projects, so it's influenced my thinking, you know, along these years while developing the script and travel and do video works. And during the shooting also, the life of the actors and the location change, and also at the editing stage, you know, we also adapt to what we feel, because I always believe that the movie itself has its own life. So they will tell you while you edit, like, what they want to be, what they want to, yeah.
The scenes themselves, the scenes will talk to you, you mean?
Right. But we have very short time for our discussion. I mean the film and myself.
Yes. So you're not cutting me off. Thanks.
Yeah, because we just finished shooting in the middle of January, and so the Cannes election submission is very was very soon in April, and so we had little time. So I am my editor now to try our best from our instinct. And while we're sending the tape off to Cannes, we're not really sure. Like, we look at each other and do we make a mess of this? We couldn't tell, you know, like other filmmakers and editor, you know, of course, if you're in this profession, you know that when you're with the footage, you saw the footage, you saw the sequence for hundreds of times, you know.
Yeah, but your film is sort of different. You can't really tell if you've made a mess of it or not, because it comes in so many different scenes and different pacings and different episodes, if you like. And then one kind of jungle episode leads to another episode in a room. You know, maybe you did get it wrong, but I certainly couldn't tell. It's a new way of telling stories that you have given us, I think.
Yeah, so we didn't know if this episode will make sense when put together. They meant through time, you know. So that's when the reviews or some positive things came out, you know, we say, oh, okay, it works, but this baby works.
Yeah, but your films are more about are quite sensual, aren't they? They're more about feeling and the sort of you grow meaning out of it. It's not like a normal film where someone does something and you follow them and there's a beginning and middle and an end. Your films have a beginning, middle and end, but not necessarily in that order.
I feel like I like to make this film like trees, you know. We talk about life and past life, and so the structure, we want to focus on the idea of fluidity, you know, of like branch going on in different unpredictable way, you know, reason. So I think that's part of the heart of the movie too, you know, the structure.
But it's kind of good, and you've taken it on. I absolutely adored your film as well, and I thought Cam was a bit boring until your film came along, so I'm really, really excited. Can you tell us why you're here in the UK? You're at BFI Southbank. You've got an installation there as well. Is that right? The Phantoms of Nebula?
Yeah, it's part of this same project, actually, called Primitive, and Phantoms of Nebula is commissioned by Animate Projects. It's a London-based company, and it's a part of the impression, in my impression, working with the teenagers in the village of the Northeast, and it's one screen installation.
Mm-hmm. And is this the same village? This is the same village where Uncle Bunmi is taking place.
Well, no, not really. It's the same region, but not, because in this particular work is more about memory.
Mm.
But this single screen is just part of the whole memory of this village.
Right, it's rather beautiful. You've got these teenagers playing football with a football of fire.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Like action movie, no?
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant. Better than Shaolin Soccer, I thought. But I also thought that, you know, with the World Cup coming up in South Africa, the Football World Cup, you know, they could be playing with this. They would absolutely win it if they can play football with this.
Maybe
it's
you
brilliant.
Can suggest to them, you know, turn off, turn the light off, and then have the football on fire.
Yeah, that's cheaper than floodlights, I think. It's a beautiful piece. It's on at BFI Southbank at the gallery there, so it's free for everyone to go and see. So you can actually see a work by the Palme d'Or winning director for free at BFI Southbank, which I think is brilliant. Apichatpong Virasatakul, do come back to the UK soon, and come back on Film Weekly when we'll see your film when it's released here in the UK. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure talking to you.
And Uncle Bunmi, Who Can Recall Past Lives, is a gem you'll probably see first here at the London Film Festival next October before a wider release in early 2011. That's what I'm hearing. New Wave Pictures have picked it up for distribution. Meanwhile, you can see Apichatpong's installation for free at the BFI Gallery at BFI Southbank. And after that excitement, I'm joined by Guardian critic Zan Brooks to discuss some of this week's releases here in the UK, including Sex and the City 2 and Noel Clarke's 4321. Zan, back from Cannes with a bump.
Here we are, back again. This time last week we were on a yacht, weren't we?
I know. I'm sorry that we can't give you that every week, but we do have a little canal. We could probably get you on a barge outside the canal.
That'd be good,
at the back of the Guardian here. This is what people want, isn't it? These are kind of big films that are, you know, after the art house kind of festival that we've been at. These are films that are going to get audiences going to the cinema, aren't
I think it? It's probably true, isn't it? But it's a bit of a giddy, whiplashing whirl for us to kind of get off the plane and then go straight into Sex and the City 2.
I think most critics, I managed to avoid it, but Dwayne The Rock Johnson's film The Tooth Fairy was the first film people'd seen after Cannes.
I like Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Oh no, he's a fine performer. I don't think he'll be troubling the jury.
Well,
at Cannes.
I don't know. Given the quality of the American films in competition at Cannes, particularly Fair Game, that was the only film up for the Palme d'Or, I think Dwayne The Rock Johnson would have fitted slotted right in.
Actually, do you know what? I made a complete mistake, because he did once trouble the jury at Cannes, because he was in Southland Tales, Richard Kelly's film.
Yeah, you see.
Yeah, he did trouble the he troubled me around. As well, I've got to tell you, with that film, in all its formats.
He looked quite troubled himself in that film. He obviously had no idea what was
going on. He wasn't alone, let's put it that way. Zan, let's start with Sex and the City 2, because that's what the girls want. It's kind of football for girls, this, although which division is it?
I'm so bad on football, but this is kind of Froome Town, I think. This is quite low.
They just got promoted. You don't know anything.
This put me in mind a little bit. It's mainly set in Abu Dhabi, which put me in mind of, you know, that thing of sort of a bunch of clapped out old entertainers, singers or comedians or a band that you think had given up the ghost ages ago, and then you find them on a cruise liner or playing in Tenerife for the tourists. And this is the equivalent here. They've been like shipped out to Abu Dhabi to go through the same old routines.
Yeah, don't forget, it does start with the world's gayest wedding.
It does, though. With Swans and Liza Minnelli.
Liza Minnelli singing. It's a Beyonce track, Single Ladies.
Single Ladies, Put a Ring on It.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. Yeah.
Put a sock in it, more like.
Zan, you're on fire.
I'm really cooking the gas.
Didn't you think her head looked like it had been CGI'd on to like a different body? It looked like one of those kind of YouTube mashups.
I thought it was going to get a bit creepy at some point, that the head was going to sprout legs like the one in The Thing and run across the room.
In fact, they were all a bit like that. Certainly in the early part, Sarah Jessica Parker looked like an old Jewish grandma. Mm. Kim Cattrall, who was, I thought, quite good in The Ghost recently for Roman Polanski. Yeah. Hideous here. They all look like men in drag now. Is that the fate of kind of fashionable women?
I don't know. And I think we're straying onto very dodgy territory in terms of actresses aging here.
Yes, I know, but not as dodgy territory as Sex in the City 2 itself was when it goes to Abu Dhabi.
Yeah.
And kind of affects to be like a Jaffa Panahi film about the sort of plight of Muslim women.
It is a little bit, you know, they talk about the Chris Morris film Four Lions being potentially hazardous. This, in its idiotic, feather-headed way, is far more offensive. And it has, you know, scenes in which the women lift up their hijabs to show that actually they're all into sort of Western fashions and things
after
like that.
After all, so they're
it's
all right, really.
A bit dodgy.
Isn't it?
I kept thinking Osama bin Laden was going to come on and sing Dancing Queen or something as the big showstopper.
It would have been good.
They're putting the fun in fundamentalism with this film, aren't they, the girls?
It's why are they going to Abu Dhabi? We can't wait. Because New York's in recession, but isn't it particularly like it's hit them very hard? They all live in marvellous apartments.
No, they're going to Abu Dhabi because Samantha has been employed by some Arab sheikh to help with his PR
one
exercise.
One sheikh shake, as Sarah Jessica Parker so wittily puts
it. Yeah. It's a bit like those sort of Bob and Bing movies, the road movies, when they really ran out of steam.
And they ended up doing them here. In the road to
with sort of terrible back Guildford projections or somewhere. Of Tahiti, when actually it was at Shepperton or something. And this has that feel of this sort of exhausted running off the road. And I have to say, I actually quite like the TV series.
I love the TV series.
I thought the TV series was funny, it was insightful, it was warm, it was well observed. None of that is here.
I mean, I also didn't mind the first movie as an event movie, which people can go to. And I know they did lots of kind of screenings with kind of Cosmopolitans and all that and kind of free shoes. And, I mean, I'm kind of all for that. And I kind of like a Cosmopolitan. Don't mind a pair of shoes, actually, myself. But Carrie Bradshaw in the original, she was kind of witty. She was wise. She kind of turned things on the head. Yeah. You kind of agreed with her. Suddenly found in this film, I don't know who's writing Sarah Jessica Parker's or SJ's script anymore, but she was a harridan. She was a pain in the arse.
Yeah, she was, wasn't she? There's a sort of mean-spiritedness to this film that I think wasn't in the last film and wasn't in the series. And it's just exhausted. It's knackered. The last film, it has to be said, did phenomenally well. What was it, 2 years ago, 2 summers ago? This, I'm sure, will do less well. But if this is the only girl power movie that's programmed as a sort of counter to the World Cup, then, you know, if that's the only game in town, people will still go.
Yeah, there's a karaoke moment where they sing I Am Woman, but they're all dressed up in their kind of, you know, Arab sheikh things. It reminded me of that final scene from Mamma Mia where they come back in 70s glam.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of secondhand reheated ingredients in here.
That's Sex and the City 2. Zam, we're now going to play a bit of tag because you've seen one film and I haven't seen another. And for those of you who are having a go at Zam for not having caught the Cannes winner last week, it's not his fault. You know, we can't see everything.
I'm going to make this my shtick. I'm going to come up here and just talk about films that I haven't seen.
Uncle Zam.
I'll just say, didn't see it,
Uncle Zam, who can recall films he hasn't seen. Elia Suleiman, The Time That Remains. This was at Cannes last year, is that
it
right?
It was, and I saw it. That's where I saw it first. I've seen it again since. This is, I guess, the third part of a vaguely linked trilogy by the Palestinian filmmaker Elia Suleiman, whose preoccupation, I guess, is the Israeli state and its relationship to
the Israeli occupation.
Yeah, and its relationship to the Palestinian people. And this is his semi-autobiographical, reinvented memoir of his family, and it's based on the diaries of his father, who was a resistance fighter in 1948, and then it follows him through his arrest, this mock execution, and his subsequent disillusion with the cause. Elia Suleiman pops up in various guises. He pops up with an actor playing him as a teenager and then appears as Elia Suleiman looking after his widowed mother in some very sort of touching tableaus towards the end.
But his films are also quite jokey, aren't they, the way he sort of pops up?
They are in a very unorthodox way. He's tends to be compared to Buster Keaton. There's a lot of deadpan, lugubrious humour in here, some sort of perfectly constructed little sight gags and things like that. It's an acquired taste.
Yes, I mean, Divine Intervention, I suppose, is his probably most famous film. And then this one's the next, is it?
This is the next one, the one after that. I think he spends a long time making these films because they are deeply personal. As I say, it's an acquired taste. He's not for everybody.
And this is because of the way he tells the story? They're kind of episodic. They're not beautifully made films, are they? Or do they have
And you sometimes wonder what he's trying to say.
Right.
They're political films with no obvious political agenda.
He's not a big fan of the Israel.
He's not a big fan of the Israel.
That much I've worked
out. And he's a big fan of the Palestinian cause, clearly. But this isn't tub-thumping polemic at all. If anything, he's adopting an almost like a judo stance to Israeli occupation, that he kind of bends from it and sees the absurdity in it and refrains from obvious retaliation. That can be frustrating, I think. And I think a lot of people are exasperated by Elia Suleiman, but at the same time, he's an incredibly distinctive personal filmmaker, and there's no one else making films like this. And because of that, I would recommend The Time That Remains. It's not a perfect film. It's full of flaws, but it's strange and has rewards in there.
That is on release in London at the same time that the Israeli film Lebanon is on release, at the same time that Eyes Wide Open is also released. We have a sort of panoply of filmmaking available for us here in London that perhaps isn't available in those countries themselves.
If you go from one screening to the other, you'll have covered all sides of the argument.
Really? Yes. It'd be amusing to kind of go neutrally between one or two.
There's a feature in that, isn't there?
Exactly. And a whole costume change as well. Perhaps we should ask the girls from Sex and the City how they do it. What a triple bill. Instead, we could go see Noel Clarke's 4-3-2-1.
Tell me about this.
I've seen this one. I'm not sure you have. No, you haven't seen this one.
No, I saw 1-2-3-4 a couple months ago. Is this kind of memento-ish?
This is version of 1-2-3-4. No, it's not. And nor is it a follow-up to the Romanian Palme d'Or winner, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. Yeah, exactly.
And if they do a sequel, it'll be 4-3-2-1-2.
Yeah, exactly, which sounds like a formation that might be used at the next World Cup. But no, this is Noel Clarke's film, which tells the story of four girls, and it splits apart into each one of them gets their own kind of little sort of tableau. It kind of, a bit like Jackie Brown did for that heist sequence. He kind of does it all the time. So you've got Tamsin Egerton, who's the sort of leggy blonde that was in St. Trinian's. Emma Roberts, who's the niece of Julia Roberts. And you have to say that every time you mention Emma Roberts. Yeah, she's not really very good, but she is the niece of Julia Roberts.
That guarantees your career these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think people who aren't related, Ophelia Lovibund, who's just got a brilliant name. She was briefly in Chatroom in Cannes, actually.
Oh, yeah.
She was very briefly in Nowhere Boy as well. And a newcomer to me, Shaniqua Warren Markland. They play four girls from different walks of life who, because of some diamond heist that goes wrong, that ends up with the diamonds on the streets of London, in fact, on the streets of the Westfield Shopping Centre, they end up kind of having to go on these little adventures. One goes to New York, one gets trapped in someone else's flat, the one's brother is a gangster, and they all run around London, and then the heist goes wrong. And meanwhile, there are kind of cameos from Kevin Smith, yes, the director, Kevin Smith.
Yeah, what's on he doing in the Westfield?
He's not at the Westfield, he's on the aeroplane, because Tamsin Edition has to go to New York for some reason, for an audition for some classical pianist, because not only is she tall and blonde and kind of spends a lot of time in her underwear, she can play the piano like Liberace.
Yeah.
And anyway, she gets to sit next to Kevin Smith on the aeroplane, and he just kind of tirades at her. And I remember there was a bit, there was Kevin Smith got thrown off an airline recently for being too fat.
Yeah.
And he calls himself Big Larry in this, and has to move across in the seats because he's too fat.
He can laugh at himself,
can't he just? Mandy Patinkin pops up as the pianist teacher. Ben Miller, he's the dad of one of them as well. So there's all sorts of cameos in here, and it's really fast moving. It's one of those kind of zip zip zap films with kind of good kind of grime music on it. I mean, it's Noel Clark.
You like Noel Clark?
I do. I think he's a sort of force for good, because I mean, he is a sort of young black Londoner. And I don't think that the British film industry really knows what to do with people like him.
I think you're probably right. And also another thing that has to be said is his films do connect with a wider audience in a way that possibly no other British director does.
Which wasn't brilliant.
No, but I heard teenagers talking about that very enthusiastically on tube trains.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't hear that about other British directors making films in the UK.
No, he's very connected. He was a BAFTA rising star last year, and I think his star is on the rise. I think he's got energy. I mean, if you look at the poster for this film, it's kind of lurid. It kind of looks like the sort of front of an R&B collected hits kind of thing.
Right.
But there's something about it that's got ambition, and certainly the story has. I mean, as I say, it's slightly Tarantino-esque. I think you sort of need to be Tarantino to pull it off entirely, and all the strands go together. But they sort of work. I mean, two or three of the strands kind of really kind of do well. And there's an energy to it. There's a lot of preening and there's a lot of strutting, but some of the language is really funny. And there are some really sort of...
He's not untroubled by ego, is he, as old Noel Clark?
No, I'll give him that. But I think in a way, to be a good director, you need a bit of sort of ice in your heart.
Yeah.
I think David Lean was sort of just the same, was just a bit, you know, not from, you know, West London.
Yeah.
So I think that there's something really interesting there, and I hope the film does really well. I think it's got that kind of, let's call it bling, that's going to do well. And I just don't think any other British directors kind of even go there.
Yeah,
and
I think we need Noel Clark.
Yeah, we need more Noel Clarks. And well, if we haven't got any more, we can have to do with this one for the moment before he probably goes to Hollywood, which I think this is probably a calling card for
that. Sounds a little bit like that.
But, you know, who's to stop him going there and making his millions? As long as he comes back and makes a bit more energy, another breath of fresh air for the British film industry. So we support Noel Clark. It's not a brilliant film, but I kind of liked it nevertheless. Zan, lovely to see you. You can, of course, read all of Zan's musings, video clips, and columns on guardian.co.uk/film. In 1971, when the Rolling Stones were at the pinnacle of their fame, they were landed with a tax bill they could not foot. The result being they left English shores and moved to the south of France, where in a beautiful villa, Nelcott, close to Cannes in Villefranche-sur-Mer, the band recorded what's widely held to be their masterpiece, Exile on Main Street. To mark the reissue of that album, a very fine documentary has been made to tell the story of the making of the record. As it was conceived on the Côte d'Azur, it was a fitting homage to both the band and their chroniclers that the doc should be screened at last week's Cannes Festival before airing on BBC One last Sunday night. Cannes is where I met up with the men behind Stones in Exile, director Stephen Kayak and the British producer John Batsek. In front of an audience at the UK Pavilion on the beach in Cannes, I discuss with Stephen and John how the film was born.
So a year ago, almost today, at this festival, Victoria Pearman, who's the co-producer on the film and who runs Jagged Films with Mick Jagger, to say they were thinking of making a documentary that would go alongside the remastering and re-release of the album Exile on Main Street. And as soon as they started talking about it, Mick had decided that he wanted a film that would stand on its own two feet. So he wanted a bona fide documentary. Would I and Passion be interested in producing it? And I took 0.00001 of a second to say yes, of course.
But did you know what sort of documentary it would be?
No. And then what happened was we met with a bunch of directors, to be honest, and we started to sort of bounce ideas around with Mick, me, and then a couple of directors and Victoria just about what this might be. And, you know, at various points it was like, oh, we'll get a whole bunch of different contemporary bands to record some of the songs and we'll film them and blah, 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 blah. But it sort of eventually got to a point where we found Stephen and we all hit upon this idea of a sort of, in the style of Cocksucker Blues and in sort of a, in the style of that great Bruce Weber, Chet Baker film, Let's Get Lost, a film that would be made up largely of the outtakes from the Robert Frank film Cocksucker Blues, of which the Stones in this vault that they have in London have like thousands and thousands and thousands of feet that basically no one's ever really looked at.
So most of this stuff has never been seen before. That's the kind of big reveal.
A lot of this stuff, yeah. And in fact, there's some sequences that have never been seen before.
Yeah, that was the idea. I mean, I think the first few words that were... I mean, when I met Victoria for the first time, it was like a memory film, unconventional, just something slightly more vibey and, you know, no talking heads. They wanted something just really special. And when we found out that the Robert Frank material would be the kind of foundation of it, it got really exciting.
Cocksucker Blues is one of the legendary music docs shot by a photojournalist, really, rather than a sort of documentary maker Robert Frank. And that was the stuff that they had. The Stones own that, do they? And they have
they
it
do.
In their,
I mean,
their
even,
garage.
Even the film itself, if people don't know, I mean, it was filmed on the 1972 tour for Exile. And it was just basically groupies getting shagged on airplanes, people shooting up, really the ennui of being a rock star. And the Stones were having so many problems getting in and out of countries at that time anyway, you know, with Keith and Mick's drug problems and busts and all that. They put it on a shelf. They said, we can never show this. This will ruin us. So even that's been kind of very hard to see. So we have that material, the outtakes, which are extraordinary. And then we just pulled in some other photographers, like Dominic Tarley, who spent 6 months at Villa Nelcott just photographing them nonstop. And even his photographs were published in a very rare, limited edition. So, you know, then we have some of his rare negatives, contact sheets. The late Jim Marshall, you know, the great Jim Marshall, who did the, you know, Johnny Cash, fuck you photograph, handed me a stack of his contact sheets from Sunset Sound, where they finished the album. So we really, it was a gold mine. What we didn't have was narrative or a story.
When did it emerge what story you were going to tell? I mean, essentially, it's sort of the making of the album, but it's not. It's almost more of a social history and a story of friends as well. There's a kind of the dynamics of the band that emerged throughout that.
Yeah, well, if you read, I mean, there are a few key books that address Exile. Primarily, there's two. One's out of print, and it's Rolling with the Stones, which was, you know, written by their drug dealer, credible source. And a lot of that was pillaged by a very great journalist, Robert Greenfield, you know, who wrote the book A Season in Hell with the Rolling Stones. He spent a few weeks at Nelcott. He wrote the big first major interview with Keith Richards for Rolling Stone magazine in 71. But again, he was there for about 2 weeks. And no disrespect to the man, but the book is sex and sex and drugs and drugs and drugs and drugs and rock and roll.
And we don't want
so
that in cinema.
It's very titillating. It's very great, you know. But we were charged to make this tell the story of an album. So we just kind of flipped the mix a bit and really made it about the music. You know, you read those books, and the only people that aren't really interviewed are the Rolling Stones. So we had them. So let's hear it from their side. And they basically said, well, you know, there were parties going on upstairs, but we were in this hot, sweaty basement trying to make a fucking record. You know, it was hard work. So for us, it was the journey into the process of making the record. And then out of that, you try to mine the roots of the album.
Tell us some of the stories that you unearthed when you were looking at the outtakes, some of the sequence that you...
Careful what you
when
say.
You found them and then decided to put them in your film.
Is my lawyer here? I think our favorite interview, I don't know if you'll agree, we discovered that there was an 8-year-old boy who was brought there by his father. Tommy Weber was a friend of Keith and Anita's. He's described in the film as a race car driver, drug smuggler, adventurer. But then they were invited down to the villa for Mick's wedding, and he used his little 8-year-old son as a drug mule. He taped cocaine to him and put him on a plane and said, let's go to the wedding with the wedding present. And this kid grew up to be Tom. It's Jake Weber, who's on American television star on the show Medium. You know, he plays Patty Arquette's husband. Great guy. And so he was like, yeah, I was 8 and a half. I remember everything. It was decadent, but we were a family. And then, like, Anita is portrayed in a lot of these books as this kind of black magic spell casting drug demon. And he's like, she was like everyone's mom, you know? So it was a cool shift in perspective.
When you said that the Cocksucker Blues was about the tour, was it an American tour or world tour? The American tour. So the stuff that you get from Nell Cock, which from Dominique Tarly, the French person who speaks like this, or the whistle, he's great. It kind of was a bit like, oh, that's like Man on Wire. There's something about those French people from that time who are kind of really good at narrating their own stories. Where did you get the footage of that, or is that all? That's his photos come to life.
His photographs. Yeah, I mean, that was because he was there for 6 months. I really enjoyed talking to him, and it was a really, really good interview. And it was sort of his perspective that said it was like a tribe, with some pot and some Jack Daniels mixed in for good measure. But, you know, he saw it as a big family, and that the fact that there were kids around, and it was summer in the south of France, and there was a real magical element to it, and they obviously did tunnel into their darkness, and Keith had to sort of, in a way, be allowed to be that loose and fucked up, I think, really, to kind of get, like, all Baudelaire on it and get really into it. And it find his way into this album. It's really Keith's record in a lot of ways.
I mentioned before that it's a sort of, in a way, some sort of social document as well, because I don't know about albums. They just don't make them like that anymore.
No, they don't.
I don't think. I wasn't there when Dizzy Rascal made his last one, but I'm sure it was pretty sedate affair. I mean, it just looked fantastic being a rock star back then. I don't know if it is as good now. Probably, I don't know. I haven't asked
any. No way.
You hang out with more of them than I do.
They never looked so beautiful and so... You know, it's like that elegantly wasted thing. A friend of mine saw it in New York recently and just went, ah, Keith's hair in the 70s, wow. You know, I mean, they never looked cooler.
Dominic Tarly showed up at the house for an afternoon of taking photographs, and at the end of the day he was packing his stuff up, and he said, and Keith said, no, you can stay, it's all right. And Stephen says, in the film, he says to Dominic, so how long did you stay? And the answer just comes out, 6 months.
I mean, it really, a film makes you want to have been there. And they're skinny, they've got T-shirts, they look cool, it's a good look. It's all very now in terms of the fashion kind of aspect of it. And that Let's Get Lost kind of template that you have, which is one of my favourite music films of all time. The actual kind of stuff, the archive you've got of Mick's wedding, the kind of stuff of the south of France in that time, where was all that? Was that...
Oh, that's like, you know, you just buy that up from expensive archives and things, and you kind of find stuff that makes sense. And we kind of got lucky in that when they made Shine a Light, there was archive sprinkled throughout Shine a Light, which is essentially a concert film. But their archival researcher, and the budget on that was gargantuan compared to ours, so they just gave an archival researcher a huge chunk of change and just said, get everything. So I think that's really, it was like from 63 till yesterday, get us everything. And so they had like masses of logs of archive.
There were a couple of points on this film where we discovered something on YouTube that had bypassed everyone.
Really? That's where... I mean, seriously. Is that becoming an archival source now, YouTube, to rival the BBC?
Yeah, you look through it. You've got your archival researcher doing this stuff, but then at night you're like YouTubing, and you go, wait a minute. And then you call her up, you're like, why didn't you find this? Where the hell did this come from? It was mind-boggling.
Can you then get it? Do you just email the person, the poster? And The film does capture this kind of era of rock and roll, and then you put the music on it. When you say Mick Jagger's remastering the album, it's coming out, I think, as a double CD.
They've remastered the original album, plus also at the time, back in the day, they wrote 10 other songs, which they've now recorded, which are now part of this new XL on Main Street album, includes the 10 new songs, so to speak, that have been recorded. That's what's been released. In fact, I think last week.
Right, it is out now. It's just because that's the fun of the clip we heard, and we were just as that guitar came in, and you were just like, that's what the Stones do so well. It's their kind of when their bridges kind of become riffs, and you just kind of fantastic. You selecting the tracks, and what, in a sense, you're sort of building your own album yourself on a kind of metatextual level as a documentary maker. You're kind of sitting back and then kind of reinterpreting the song. That must be kind of in the edit stage. That must be the real creative fun as much.
Well, you get lucky with this one because there are 18 songs, and I think we squeeze 16 of them in really significant ways within an hour. So it was pretty chock full, and a lot of them actually seem to speak to kind of plot points. So you really could sort of, you know, manipulate that and use them in these certain ways. Like the tempo of one song may suggest, you know, we have a sequence of travel when the saxophone player says, yeah, they called me and we play with them and they were like, hey, we're coming to France, so let's go, everybody. And we found footage, you know, of people loading into airplanes and all this. So it was everything sort of came together and you're like, well, that's got to be, like, we got to use one of the ups. Like, I was rip this joint or something. But, like, then you find the song that kind of locks together with it.
Plus, also, yeah. Mick, you know, he had strong views about which songs he thought should be in and where they should be in. And, again, whenever I talk about documentaries, and this I include this one, it's one of the things that I find most enjoyable about them is it is a collaboration between the inner circle of people making a film. And Mick was integrally involved in a lot of that sort of stuff. And
we don't mention working with filmmakers, and you mentioned Mick Jagger as producer. I mean, the guy he's a film producer himself. He's been an actor. He has kind of great connection with film. When it's dealing with his own, I mean, I know him and Martin Scorsese collaborated quite a lot on Shine a Light. In fact, there's a sequence at the beginning of Shine a Light where he's arguing with Scorsese on who's the better director, kind of on what to do. Scorsese's like, shit. How was he to work with? I mean, you have to give us the warts and all, but how was he to work with him? What was his filmic input against his kind of autobiographical input?
You know, it's hard to say this without sounding like a groupie. He was basically great to work with. You know, there were, as there are with whether you work with Mick Jagger or Joe Schmo, who happens to be one of the characters in another film you're making, there were moments where there was stuff in the film that he wasn't crazy about, and we battled with him on a bunch of stuff, and we won some of the battles and we lost some of the battles.
I mean, Mick was, you know, popped into the edit 2-3 times. We'd show him cuts. They were actively involved, so it was a real dialogue. And, you know, like you said, we'd push back, he'd push back. It was a give and take. You win some, you lose some. You know, like, oh, does the fistful of cocaine shot stay in? No. Oh, damn it. All right. But then, you know, Mick on his little Stairmaster shot when he's talking about the mountain to climb with all this new material. You know, he thinks it's silly. We like it. It's kind of this back and forth thing. And you just...
Not to interrupt you, but yeah. What does a fistful of cocaine look like?
Like, imagine that.
Like that.
Full of, you know, okay. Come on. It's not hard to imagine.
Never been that wealthy.
I think we knew going into it that there would be... That there could be moments where there was something in the film that we felt strongly about that we did want in, that they felt strongly that they did not want in. And if that ever happened, ultimately, they would, their rule would, you know, we'd go with what they said.
And they were very happy to go back over, obviously it was their idea to go back over this, but what you get in your film is the kind of tabloid frenzy that surrounded them at the time. You know, they left England and then all the spinning kind of newspaper headlines, you know, they did drugs. I mean, now we kind of, yeah, of course rock stars do drugs, it's not a big story, but then it kind of shocked British society to its very core that these young men with their long hair were doing drugs of all things in the name of popular music. You have to really recapture that. Was Mick good at remembering that and how besieged they were? Because for us, it must be hard to, shut up, stop whinging, you're in Nelcott. But it was quite a problem that the UK was sort of disgusted in general with these people.
Yeah, that was the trick. You know, you have 60 minutes, you have the whole story of this album to tell, but you have to set it up. And that was, there were many variables while they left. They were hounded by the government. They were being chased for drugs all the time. So it was a pressure cooker feeling in the UK. I think Keith is the one that seems to, like, kind of remember it most and had the most to say about it. Mick just seemed to think, well, that wasn't that important. We really were broke. You know, Mick's mind is on the money. Keith was just like, you know, we couldn't leave the house. They were on us all the time. If they couldn't bust us for drugs, they were going to get us out some other way. So they came after their money. And what I think people forget is that there was a time when, like, rock bands and, like, the Stones were dangerous. I mean, they were the biggest band in the world, but they had, like, outlaw status. They were a danger to polite society, and the government wanted them gone. It was a real driving force to oust them however they could.
Do you remember politically what it was like? And there's a bit when you know, where your most famous band decided that the tax brackets are too high, and they leave. This is this kind of it's quite a shock. Whoever the government of the day are, I mean, it's not a winner of the youth vote, is it? When you're forcing the best man out, they were saying it was 90% taxation at the time. 93% taxation. Wow. So that was it. Was a political gesture as well.
It was as much an economic gesture as it was a political gesture, because they were, if they stayed, they were going to be in serious financial trouble, because they aren't the first band to do this, but they had a very shaky management deal which was creaming off a lot of the money that they would have been made. The fact is, with the tax laws at that level, they had to get out of the country in order to earn some money.
And this is what they did, and they made this album. In what way do you think that the music is affected by the exile? Obviously, it becomes the title of the album. The title of your film is Stones in Exile. In what way did their music change? Did their attitudes change to fit this new situation they were in?
It was like they were like a fighter on the ropes, you know what I mean? The album got dirtier, it got grungier, partly because of the circumstances in which they recorded it. They weren't in their comfortable studios anymore. They were stuck in these grungy old basements. They had their mobile recording truck hot-wired to the train cables to get electricity, and they were recording in a real rough fashion. But it's a nasty record. It's dark, and it's got an edge to it that music really hadn't had up to that point. But in a way, there was a reaction to all that, but there was something really liberating about being down here. And like Keith said, like, I'd never lived on top of the factory before.
Mick Jagger's here, isn't he? He's not in the house, unfortunately, or in the pavilion. But he is here to launch the film here at the festival. Wow, exciting. Is he going to be on stage at the Cannes Inn?
Never quite, though, but I think
so. Yeah, absolutely. Well, if not, ladies and gentlemen, it remains for me, Jason Solomons, to thank John Batsek and Stephen Kayak for Stones in Exile for today's talk. Thanks to Stephen Kayak and John Batsek. That special reissue of Exile on Main Street is out now. Top of the album charts, indeed. And if you're a UK listener, you can probably catch the film on BBC's iPlayer for the next week or so. Thanks to BFI Southbank for lending us the Palme d'Or winner, Apijatpong Virasattakul. Say it one last time and that's it. The music you've been listening to, well, that's self-explanatory. It's taken from Stones in Exile, and it's making us sound just a little bit like a Scorsese movie, no? Anyway, from me, Jason Solomons, and the combined production strength of Jason Phipps and Ben Green, a big Film Weekly welcome to Ben's firstborn, Noah Seamus, indeed. Until next week, from all of us, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.